evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
IOM has launched, you know, a major response plan, if you will, which is looking at how we can best support the migrants as they're en route to Europe primarily. And part of that involves ensuring that we're supporting the saving of lives, protecting their rights, and above all, addressing the drivers of what's called irregular and forced migration.
That's Leonard Doyle, spokesperson for the International Organization for Migration. The IOM launched an updated response plan for complex migration flows. We'll have full details coming up.
Also, the UN Security Council condemns the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab attack yesterday on a Mogadishu hotel that left at least 12 people dead. And the Vatican announces that Pope Francis' November visit to the Central African Republic may be canceled if violence increases in the country.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the United Nations Security Council condemned the Somali militant group's Al-Shabaab attack yesterday on a Mogadishu hotel that left at least 12 people dead, including the owner of the hotel, a military commander, and two lawmakers. The council praised the response by Somalia's army, which killed all of the attackers, and highlighted terrorism all its forms and manifestations as one of the most serious threats to global peace. The members of the Security Council reiterated their determination to support Somalia's transition to greater peace and stability. They underlined that neither this nor any other terrorist attack would weaken that determination. Authorities said the militants set off a car bomb at the entrance of the Sahafi Hotel. Then gunmen stormed the site, which is popular with government officials and business executives. Somali Security Minister Abdirazak Omar Mohamed told VOA the attackers were wearing Burundian military uniforms, which he says may have obtained during Al-Shabaab's deadly attack on a Burundian military base in Ligo in June this year.
Among those killed was General Abdi Karim Yusuf Dagbadan, a former army commander who led the offensive that forced Al-Shabaab to retreat from Mogadishu in August 2011. General Dagbadan previously survived several Al-Shabaab attempts on his life. Al-Shabaab spokesman Sheikh Abdi Aziz Abu Masab claimed responsibility for the attack in a statement yesterday. In recent months, Al-Shabaab has blown up another Mogadishu hotel, overrun three African Union peacekeepers' base in Somalia, and detonated a bomb on the grounds of Somalia's presidential palace. The groups control most of southern Somalia as recently as 2010, but was pushed into the countryside by African Union and Somali government forces. The militants carry out frequent attacks, often targeting government officials and African Union troops. This group seeks to impose a strict form of Islamic law on the country and has frequently beheaded, stoned to death, or amputated the limbs of people accused of various crimes.
The Vatican has announced that Pope Francis' November visit to the Central African Republic may be canceled if violence increases in the country. The Pope is scheduled to visit a refugee camp in the capital, Bangui. He's also scheduled to meet Muslim and Christian leaders in a mosque on November 30th at the end of a four-day Africa tour. Mob violence late last week resulted in the deaths of three Muslims and a Christian. The killings add to the more than 6,000 dead in 2 years of sectarian fighting between Christian and Muslim militias. The recent violence could also threaten presidential and parliamentary elections on December 13th. Pope Francis addressed tens of thousands of people in St. Peter's Square in Rome yesterday and called for an end to the cycle of violence in the Central African Republic. About 400,000 civilians live in 28 camps for the displaced. An equal number have fled the country. The International Organization for Migration, IOM, has updated its June 2015 response plan addressing complex migration flows in the Mediterranean. The new plan includes a series of proposed interventions that will be implemented through December 2016. The document details four objectives for a coordinated response in addressing the needs and rights of migrants. It integrates required actions for countries throughout Europe, parts of sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, and North Africa. Leonard Doyle is a spokesperson for IOM. He highlights the main objectives of the plan and what will be required for countries to implement it.
IOM has launched, a major response plan, if you will, which is looking at how we can best support the migrants as they're en route to Europe primarily. And part of that involves ensuring that we're supporting the saving of lives, protecting their rights, and above all, addressing the drivers of what's called irregular and forced migration.
So actually, this is going to be addressing the issue as they are in transit from their home countries going into Europe.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the plan integrates action across countries of origin, the countries of transit and destination. And the whole point is to do it in a holistic way whereby we're coordinating across multiple countries, multiple languages, migrants and refugees who are in transit, and ensuring the best possible outcome for them and for their safety.
What are some of the things that countries are going to be required to do to help in this?
Well, one thing we need to do is to provide life-saving aid at the points where it's dangerous, provide a relief to the human suffering that's taking place, and protecting the human rights of the migrants when they're under threat from people smugglers, traffickers, and others. We're also interested in helping them make good and safe migration choices. So rather than go on a journey that they don't know the outcome of, probably better that they know the risks rather before they embark. In general, IOM wants to promote safe, orderly, and dignified human mobility, and that requires creating the conditions for migration to take place. And indeed, most of the time requires people having documents, people having a good knowledge of where they're going, and countries being willing to support their arrival.
Those countries that will be involved that do not have the necessary funds to do this, where will the money be coming from?
Well, the full expectation is that the European Union, which is the destination of many of these migrants, will create a trust fund and that many of the funds will be accessible through that fund.
Does this response plan include both migrants who are fleeing violence as well as those who are going into Europe seeking employment?
Indeed. I mean, we see the migrants as being the overall envelope of people. And within that, you have a discrete category, which are called refugees, and who are people absolutely deserving of support under the Geneva Conventions. But that's not a big enough envelope, because there are many people who fall outside that. They could be unaccompanied minors. They could be individuals who've been trafficked. They could be people who've been exploited and have had human rights abuses along the way. They may have set out as economic migrants. By the time they wash up on Europe's shores, they may be terribly in need of support and protection. So we want to make sure that the lens is a bit broader than it traditionally is.
And one of the core pillars and objectives that you have been talking about for this updated response plan, you all say to recognize the need to create the structural conditions and make systemic changes needed to enable positive outcomes of migration for all involved. Can you explain that a little bit further?
This is the hard part, is how you deal with the conditions in countries of origin. So we need to get some development going. We need to make sure that there's proper systems of governance. And we need to make countries understand that migration is a good thing, is a positive thing. And that can be the countries of origin and the countries of arrival. There's a lot of negative perceptions of migrants in the world. Part of what we're doing is campaigning to show that migrants bring a very positive benefit to society. And we have a campaign called I Am a Migrant, which is iamamigrant.org. Which seeks to show that, from whatever perspective, migration has a positive impact. From the perspective of the country of departure, these are diaspora people who will, in the future, hopefully, send funds home and invest in their local village and town that they know so well. And from the perspective of the countries of immigration, as we all know, migrants are hardworking. They fill roles that others don't want to do. And some of them are highly skilled and bring a huge additional level of expertise and diversity to the countries that they arrive in. So I think no matter how you look at the issue, the migrants have a lot to offer, and we need to help change that perception.
That was Leonard Doyle, a spokesperson for the International Organization for Migration. He spoke with us from Geneva.
V. The Italian government denies accusations that its naval vessels entered Libya's territorial waters. The government in eastern Libya claims Italian vessels were spotted in their waters over the weekend. The Italian Coast Guard has been rescuing migrants on the Mediterranean. The UN Security Council has authorized European Union vessels to rescue migrants in distress, confiscate vessels, and arrest suspected smugglers on international waters. In related news, EU President Jean-Claude Juncker is urging nations to move more quickly to process and place more than 700,000 migrants in European countries. Many EU countries are blaming Germany for encouraging migrants to continue making the perilous journey. Germany is the preferred home of many seeking sanctuary or jobs in Europe. Meanwhile, officials in Kabul, Afghanistan, say they will take back all its citizens being deported as Germany struggles to accommodate hundreds of thousands of refugees and other migrants. Afghans currently make up the second largest nationality reaching Europe. An estimated 120,000 Afghans have left the country legally and illegally. More than 76,000 Afghans have migrated to Europe so far this year.
Before the migrants and refugees reach Europe, they seek shelter away from the fighting in Syria and gather in neighboring countries. Abir Etifa is the World Food Program's regional spokeswoman for the Middle East, North Africa, and Eastern Europe. From the Saudi Arabian capital, Riyadh, she spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about WFP humanitarian operations in the region.
Well, right now we have over 4.5 million refugees who are still in neighboring countries. We are assisting around 1.3 million refugees every month. That's in the five neighboring countries between Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, Turkey, and Egypt. Our main source of challenges right now is the funding. I think in the month of September, we had to reduce the level of assistance to Syrian refugees by almost half. And we had around 229,000 refugees cut off from assistance in Jordan. Since then, some funding has been coming through, not in a way that would allow us to relatively increase the level of support for refugees. Right now, instead of receiving around $13 per person per month, we are now up to $21 per person per month. That's, again, still less than around the $28 that we were planning to assist. We also managed to bring back the 229,000 people who were removed from assistance. And I think in October, they did receive their assistance.
So what does the World Food Program need to continue its operations at the level that you would like to see?
With the current level of funding that we have, it will allow us to continue to assist people until the month of January. The same story, which is the vicious cycle of running an operation hand to mouth, not knowing what to expect in a 2 month time, doesn't allow us to plan well. What we are hoping to get and we would like to have is like the ability, the predictability of funding over a 6 month period so that we can plan and that we are able to assist people without playing with their lives. 1 month they receive, the next month they don't receive assistance. We're only reaching the extremely vulnerable and the vulnerable. Out of the 4.5 million people who are registered in neighboring countries, we're only assisting 1.3 million, which is like more or less a quarter of the population of refugees.
There's speculation that with the winter weather approaching, that it might slow down the flow of migrants and refugees. Are you seeing any evidence of that?
What I can also tell you is that over the last few months, the host countries have also made it difficult for refugees basically to arrive in borders. They have an open door policy for quite some time. They've had so many refugees in Lebanon. One in every four people is a Syrian refugee. So over a quarter of the population is Syrian refugees. What we are actually experiencing is people with desperation and the decrease in humanitarian assistance. Some people are opting out and choosing to return to Syria. Some are going home, mainly because they cannot continue to live in these host countries. They have exhausted all of their resources, all of their means of survival. And in addition, they are also experiencing some difficulties with the host communities because they are seen as a burden on these communities for over 4 years now. And some are leaving out of desperation. Others are leaving with the plan to cross inside Syria into Turkey, and maybe they can catch a boat to Europe. The influx from Syria into the neighboring countries is sort of slowing down.
Abir Etifa is the World Food Program's regional spokeswoman for the Middle East, North Africa, and Eastern Europe. From the Saudi Arabian capital, Riyadh, she spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 21 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The United Nations Security Council condemned the Somali militant group's Al-Shabaab's attack yesterday on a Mogadishu hotel that left at least 12 people dead. And the Vatican has announced that Pope Francis' November visit to the Central African Republic may be cancelled if violence increases in the country. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
An airline official says only external factors could have caused the disintegration of a Russian passenger jet that crashed in Egypt. There are no technical failures that could lead to the plane breaking up in the air. Alexander Smirnov Kogalyamavia, Charter Airlines Director of Flight, said today in Moscow, the plane wasn't flying, it was falling, Smirnov said. The crew totally lost control, and for that reason, there was not one attempt to get in contact and report on the accident situation on board. Smirnov said the Metrojet charter flight received significant damage to its construction that did not allow it to continue the flight. He said the only way to explain the crash is some kind of external action. We rule out technical faultiness of the plane. We exclude a mistake by the pilot or the crew, the so-called human factor, he said.
Smirnov, while ruling out technical and human error as the cause of the crash, also stressed the importance of waiting for the findings of the investigation into the crash. The Metrojet flight disappeared Saturday from radar over the Sinai Peninsula with 224 people aboard. Nearly all of the passengers aboard were Russian tourists returning to St. Petersburg from the Egyptian resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh. Three Ukrainians were also among the dead. Emergency crews have recovered both of the plane's black boxes, which record flight data and pilot communications.
The Associated Press reports the Nigerian army says it killed four Boko Haram militants yesterday when it drove them from an abandoned school in Borno State. The school was being used as a base. Schools have been frequent targets of the militants. UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, says more than 300 schools have been destroyed in Borno State. AP also reports Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari says negotiations with Boko Haram to free hundreds of kidnapped schoolgirls have stalled. The girls were abducted from Chibok over a year ago. Mr. Buhari is quoted as saying it's been difficult finding credible Boko Haram leaders to talk to. Mr. Buhari says last month Boko Haram had demanded the release of one of its bomb experts as part of negotiations.
The United Nations says rebels in South Sudan have released 13 UN contractors who were taken hostage last week while escorting a barge carrying fuel on the Nile River. A statement from the UN mission in South Sudan said it retrieved the South Sudanese contractors in a mission yesterday and that the barge had been returned. The UN called on the rebels from the SPLA in opposition to immediately release 55,000 liters in fuel, communications equipment, and 7 weapons that were also on board when they seized the barge on October 26th. The rebels at that time also detained 18 peacekeepers who were released after 3 days. While we today are relieved by the safe release of all UN personnel, the need for all parties to the conflict in South Sudan to fully respect unfettered free access and movement of UN personnel and assets cannot be underlined strongly enough, said UN Special Representative to South Sudan. A similar incident should not and hopefully will not happen again. The UN has 13,000 personnel working to protect civilians and help foster a regional effort to end the conflict that erupted in 2013 between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and those loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. The conflict has displaced more than 2.2 million South Sudanese, including 700,000 who fled to neighboring countries.
Millions of Nigerian school children don't attend school in part because their parents can't afford it. One state is trying to change that by abolishing fees. Chris Stein reports with Ibrahima Yakubu in Kaduna.
In theory, public primary school education in Nigeria is free. But in practice, public schools charge for uniforms, books, and meals. Those fees are often the equivalent of less than $25, but even that is too much for some families. However, the governor of Kaduna State in northern Nigeria says the state will now cover the cost of those necessities for students in public primary and junior secondary schools. Samuel Aruan is a spokesman for the state government.
With this free education, we have saved Kaduna State parents whose children attend public school of over 3 billion naira annually.
Nigeria is home to the world's largest population of out-of-school children, according to the United Nations Children's Fund. About 10.5 million children were out of school in 2012, UNICEF estimates, due to a combination of poverty, cultural traditions, and in some parts of the country, conflict. Suleiman Yakubu says he can afford to send his children to public school, but he knows many parents who can't.
The money for food to be given to a child to buy a uniform or a textbook, that's why most of these parents refuse to take their child to the school.
But some teachers in Kaduna State say getting children into school is just one challenge. A junior secondary school teacher who didn't want his name used said classrooms are overcrowded and under-equipped.
If you look at the condition per class now, it's 200 and something students per class. How will a teacher teach a children of 200 and something students in a class per period? You know, it's not an easy thing.
Kaduna started its no-fees policy in September. Aruan says it will be fully implemented when the new term starts in January. Chris Stein for VOA News, Accra.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Straight Talk Africa. We'll explore the secrets of doing business in Africa from an American corporate executive's perspective. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they share how U.S. companies can best play catch up with the fastest growing continent That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.